Well, we're almost halfway through the story of Esther, and what a wonderful story it is. We've been sitting, as it were, in the palace of one of the greatest kings to rule the world. And we have observed his splendour. We have seen the glory of his riches. We have observed the greatness of his power and his sovereignty over a vast territory around the eastern Mediterranean. We've seen how this man was full of pride, and yet how he was also interested in the affairs of his nation, to some degree at least. At least he pretends an interest. He's observant of the things that his advisors say to him. He listens to what they have to say and he follows their advice. He knows that there are rebels in his great nation, and he authorizes his right-hand man to remove them, to rid his vast territories of these people who disobey his law. He doesn't particularly know who they are. He doesn't really seem to care who they are. He just wants peace in all 127 provinces. And he wants to be recognized and honored as the sovereign lord. He doesn't want rebels. He doesn't want traitors. He wants peace. And we've noted too that around this great king, who is really only interested in himself and his own glory, he has gathered together advisers who are equally self-interested. And the advice that they give is based on what the king would like to hear rather than what the king necessarily should hear. The advice they give then is designed to ensure their continued peace and prosperity and position in the government of King Ahasuerus of Persia. We've seen too how the great nation of Persia, this vast empire, has been turned into a nation of confused people, perplexed people, people who are asking questions about its leadership because of the way the king has handled the so-called lawless element within the empire. He has decreed that on a particular day, every one of them will be blotted out, without any trial, without any test as to whether they are really lawless. One particular people group from one particular nation scattered throughout these provinces are to be annihilated. Neighbour is to turn against neighbour because of race. And this has all stemmed out of one man's hatred of that race and his ability to wheedle his way into the king's good favour. It's an incredible story. And as we go through this story, we have to remember that the people in the story don't know the outcome. It's hard for us, being so familiar with the stories of the Bible, when we come to a book like Esther, to remember that King Ahasuerus, Haman, his right-hand man, Mordecai the Jew, and Queen Esther have no idea how this story is going to unfold. They are simply living their lives, just as we do every day. We don't know what today's decisions are going to do for us tomorrow, how they're going to affect our lives, what the laws that are currently passing through Parliament are going to mean for us in the future. We don't know what chaos What perplexity, what confusion may come into our lives. We don't know what good or evil. Neither did these people. And so let us bear that in mind then, as we come to the fifth chapter of this book of Esther, to consider two people in particular, but throughout the sermon we'll be looking at four people. But two people in particular, Esther and Haman, those are the two people that this chapter focuses upon. Two people who have been advanced in this empire of Persia, partly on their own merits. Queen Esther, a queen with great beauty, the most beautiful young woman in the whole of Persia. That is how we're to understand it. She had taken part in this parade of beauty. 400 women, we're told by one historian, were brought to Susa and were brought before King Ahasuerus, and Queen Esther was chosen for her beauty. That was her great attribute, if you like. And she was advanced from being a lowly Jewish girl living in Susa, an orphan living with a cousin, to being queen of the world superpower. And then there's Haman. We have no idea how he came to be in the position that he was in, but we've already seen something of his subtlety, of his slyness. No doubt for years and years he's been gradually making his way up the ladder to success. How many people has he trodden on the way up there? We don't know. All we know is that over a period of a few years between Esther's being queen and these events of this particular chapter taking place, Haman has risen to being prime minister in Persia. The king has advanced him. Now we mustn't think that the king has just sort of put his thumb in a telephone directory and picked on the name and put him there for no particular reason. Haman obviously has gifts that the king could use. And Haman is advanced on the basis of his merits. But to a large degree, both their advancements were entirely outside of their control. Neither of them could guarantee it. Queen Esther, with all her beauty, couldn't guarantee that as she went from Mordecai's house to the king's palace, that she would be the one who would be chosen. And Haman, in all his sly dealings, in all his manipulating as he rose to the top, he couldn't guarantee that he would get there. They were very much dependent upon the good favour of the king. They have been chosen by the king, on their merits, yes, but in the end, at the whim of the king. And as we come and look at these two people, we notice that they're very different people. And for whatever reason, the king chose each one of them to their particular position. He obviously saw different things in these two people. And perhaps he saw one more clearly than the other, as we note as the story unfolds. What was Esther like? Well, we've already noted that she was acknowledged to be a beauty. Physically, she outshone everyone. We also noted, when we looked at the second chapter of Esther, that she obviously also had an attractive personality. That wherever she went, she seemed to win over those around her. It seems that she was kind and easy to get along with. put on no airs, and she became the friend of everyone who got to know her. And it was her physical beauty, but also this beauty of personality that seems to have given her all the advantages within the king's palace, and probably was the thing that made her shine out from all the other beautiful women that were there. But we can say far more about Esther than that. At the end of the last chapter, after Mordecai has heard about the edict of the king made by the hand of Haman, that all the Jews on a particular day would be blotted out, and after Mordecai has brought this news to Esther in her isolation from the real world within the king's palace, and after Mordecai has instructed Esther on what her duty may be, that she must recognize that God has raised her, advanced her to the position that she is in, possibly for this reason, that she would be able to save her countrymen. Then we hear Esther's response. She says, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. And it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat in his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. What does that tell us about Queen Esther of Persia? Well, it tells us one thing of vital significance in the whole of this story. It tells us that Esther feared God. We could go further and say it tells us that Esther feared God more than she feared man. She had a reverence for God that was greater than her reverence for even the world leader of the world superpower. She called Mordecai to gather all the Jews that were in Shushan the citadel and call them to fast for her. She would join them in the fast for 3 days and 3 nights. They would fast, and then she would approach the king. Even though it might mean that her life would be taken from her if he didn't show favour towards her, what she was doing was completely against the law. To go into the presence of the king uninvited, without a summons. But she was willing to do it, because, as Mordecai had said, perhaps she has been raised to this position in Persia for this very purpose. And she demonstrates this fear of God by her willingness to go in before King Ahasuerus on behalf of her people, on behalf of the people of God. She didn't ignore the fact that what she was doing was a dangerous thing. She wasn't careless of the reality of her situation. Remember, she doesn't know how the story unfolds. She doesn't know what's going to happen here. She knows what happened about 8 years earlier, when Queen Vashti refused to do what the king wanted her to do. When Queen Vashti displeased the king, it was the end for her. Esther knows that. Esther's well aware of the law. She's warned Mordecai of the possible consequences that this cousin that he loves and that he has brought up so carefully may be on her death march as she walks over to the king's court. She's not careless of the possible consequences. She knows exactly what she's doing, and yet she still goes, because she fears God more than she fears man. Furthermore, while she recognizes the real danger that she's in as she goes, she also recognizes that however powerful Ahasuerus is, God is more powerful. She knows the truth of Proverbs 21 and verse 1, that the king's heart is in God's hand, and he turns it like a river wherever he wants it to go. She knows that as she goes before King Ahasuerus on this morning, on the third day of her fasting. She knows that God is in control. No doubt she is familiar with Isaiah chapter 14 and God's promises to the people of Israel in all of their difficulties, in all of their uncertainty of being held in captive. God has promised that he would be with them. Sorry, not Isaiah 14, Isaiah 54. He says, "O you afflicted one, tossed with tempest and not comforted, behold, I will lay your stones with colourful gems and lay your foundations with sapphires. I will make your pinnacles of rubies, your gates of crystal, and all your walls of precious stones. All your children shall be taught by the Lord, and great shall be the peace of your children. In righteousness you shall be established. You shall be far from oppression, for you shall not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near you. Indeed, they shall surely assemble, but not because of me. But whoever assembles against you shall fall for your sake. Behold, I have created the blacksmith who blows the coals in the fire, who brings forth an instrument for his work. And I have created the spoiler to destroy. No weapon formed against you shall prosper. And every tongue which rises against you in judgment, you shall condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is from me, says the Lord. I am the one who sets the blacksmith in his place to blow on the coals to bring forth his instrument. And I am the one who creates the spoiler, the destroyer. But no weapon that blacksmith forms, no weapon that is used by the spoiler, the destroyer, shall prosper against you." No doubt Mordecai has taught her to fear the living God just as he does. He has set a great example for her of obedience to this God. She is reminded by him that God is in control. "If you remain completely silent at this time," Mordecai had said, "relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from some other place." And Esther says, "God's will be done. I will go. I will speak on behalf of my people. If I perish, I perish. But I will go." And as she goes and she stands there, you can imagine the fear that she must be feeling. And yet she has donned her royal garments. She's looking regal as she stands there at the end of this great hall. And at the other end, there's the king. What's he going to do? All his courtiers around. We mustn't think that this is just a private meeting between a king and queen. Court is in session. All the courtiers are there. The princes of the land are there. The king is there working, doing the business of state. And there he sees, as he sits opposite the door, someone comes in. It's Queen Esther. What will happen? And Esther's knees are knocking, and she's praying to God, "Grant favor, Lord, grand favour. And there the sceptre is raised to her. And she proceeds forwards the length of that hall and touches the end of the sceptre, accepting the king's mercy. And she's found favour in his sight. And the king says to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther?" He knows she's got some reason for being there. No one in their right mind would turn up and stand at that door at that time without being summoned unless they had good reason for it. And he says to her, "What is your request? It shall be given to you, up to half the kingdom." Now, it might be, as some commentators say, that this is just another demonstration of this king's rashness, that he would be willing to give her half his kingdom. 60 however many provinces. But I'm not sure that that's exactly what he means. It seems to me as though it's more likely to be a form of speech. "Whatever you want, I will do my utmost to help you. I would give my right arm." Would you? We say it, don't we? "I'll give my right arm to help so-and-so." Doesn't literally mean that we cut it off and hand it over. Of course not. And it's a similar thing here. The king is saying, "Whatever you want, whatever your request is, my queen, I will do whatever I can to assist you in this." She's found the favour that they've been praying for. And let me just comment briefly on this fact that these Jews in Shushan have been fasting. It doesn't mean that they're trying to bargain with God. It doesn't mean that they're trying to twist God's arm. It doesn't mean that they feel that somehow they've got to go on a hunger strike in order to get God's attention. Fasting in the scriptures is never presented to us as some way in which we can get God on our side, that he will feel pity for us or something like that. Fasting was an act of humility before God. It was a demonstration that someone has come to the end of themselves and they're looking to God in his mercy, in his sovereignty, to help. It's saying, "I can't do this myself. I need you, Lord God." And always associated with fasting, though it's not mentioned here in the Bible, is prayer. Prayer and fasting. The two go together. We mustn't think that all these Jews did was go without food for 3 days. No, they spent time humbling themselves before the Lord, pleading with God to act. And not to act against his will, but to act consistently with his promises. He has promised to be with them. He has promised to raise them up. He has promised that his love would never be finally taken away from them. That's always been his promise. Even when they were sent into captivity, they were told it was only for a time. And so Esther and the people in Shushan have prayed to God, asked God's blessing upon upon her efforts as she goes into the king, and the Lord has answered that prayer, has seen her humility. And the king too observes the humble way that she has come to him. And the grace that she shows as she speaks to him. Esther answers, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." And so we know the story, off they go to this banquet. And the king asks, and again gives this promise, "Whatever your petition is, whatever you want, I will do all that I can to help you." So again she says, "This is my petition, this is my request. If I found favour in the sight of the king, please come to another banquet that I will prepare for you tomorrow, and then I will answer your question. Now, Esther isn't using delaying tactics here. She's not just putting off the inevitable moment that she must ask the king to do something. Esther, no doubt, has been pleading with the Lord for wisdom, to know how is she to approach the king and to say, effectively, look, you've made a terrible mistake. You've passed this law, and it puts my people and myself under the death sentence. How do you approach a king with so great power and tell him you've made a mistake? A king who's already shown himself to be proud and pompous and not open to correction. And no doubt she's prayed, and in the Lord's providence, the events are unfolding in this way. It's similar to the instruction that James gives in James chapter 1 and verse 2. He says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. This is all in the context of persecution, of trials. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. No doubt, Esther here has been crying out to God for wisdom. And no doubt God has answered her request for favour in the king's eyes and also for wisdom in how to broach this subject with him. And so these unfolding events are all to be seen as part of God's answer to Esther's prayer, of wisdom being worked out here in these circumstances. Not that Esther necessarily knew exactly what she was doing. She obviously realised that to have asked the request straight away in that great hall, as the king is surrounded by his courtiers and the princes of Persia, would have been folly. To have humiliated him publicly in that way by pointing out a mistake. So to have a banquet, a little private affair. And it's quite right then that Haman should be there too. He's the prime minister and he's the one who drafted the law. Exactly why she delays it another day, I'm not sure. But we will see how effective it was next week. There's Esther. She's a woman who is fearful of the living God. She has this fear that Proverbs speaks about, a reverence for God, acknowledging his great power and sovereignty over her life. And she knows that this is a far greater being than King Ahasuerus, and a far more powerful being than the king of Persia. And she trusts in this God and humbles herself before this God, and she obeys this God. What about Haman? Well, he is a contrast in character and personality. Haman's been to his first banquet with the king and Esther, all by themselves. What a great privilege. And so he runs off home that day joyful and with a glad heart. And when he gets home, he calls his friends and his wife Zeresh around. And Haman told them about all his great riches. He tells them about the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above all the officials to serve in the service of the king. Besides, he says, Queen Esther invited no one but me. And the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I'm invited again. And it doesn't say it here, but these narratives are often very much truncated for us. I can imagine Haman there saying, and you know what's going on? The queen's got a request to make of the king, and I'm the only one other than the king who's actually going to hear it. I'm going to be the first in Persia to know. See how much trust the king puts in me. And see how the queen regards me, that I'm allowed to enter into their confidences. And you see a man who is so puffed up with pride. He's got an ego that fills the palace of Persia. It's incredible, this man. He has all of this and he wants more and he wants more and he wants more. And unprepared for his achievements to speak for themselves, he boasts about it. He gathers these people around himself, a little party for himself. He's an incredibly proud and boastful man. And yet, behind all of this pride and all of this boasting, we find an incredibly unhappy man as well. Haman, we're told, went out with a joyful and glad heart, but just exited the palace, having been at that wonderful banquet in the presence of the king and queen of Persia. And there at the gate, who does he meet but this Mordecai? And when he gets there, despite having a decree written against him and all of his people because of his refusal to bow, there isn't any evidence of any increase in respect or fear. He neither stands nor trembles. And Haman is filled with indignation, filled with hatred and anger. He restrains himself, but you get the idea from the narrative here. He only barely restrains himself. Haman restrained himself and went home. But oh, he's got this thorn in his flesh. He's got this burden on his back. He talks, he boasts to his family about all of his achievements. Yet, he says, yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see that Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate. I have all of this, great riches, great advancement, great honour in the kingdom, but it's all nothing, he says, while that one man lives. Poor Haman. Feel like singing a little song. Next week we will see just how childish this man really is. Two other people I said I'd mentioned this morning. Sandwiched between Esther and Haman is Mordecai. There he is, verse 9. He's back in the king's gate, not outside the king's gate. He's done his fasting. He's done his praying. He's removed his sackcloth and the ashes in which he was sat. And he's back at work. He's a magistrate once more. And he is filled with the same confidence as when he spoke to Esther. God will bring deliverance. Here comes Haman, head up high, marching out of that banquet, and Mordecai doesn't tremble. He's not afraid of Haman with all his power and prestige. He's not afraid of the law that Haman has written up against him and his fellow Jews. He is a man who is quite quietly confident in his God. And he's just getting on with life. And nothing seems to be bothering him. And I think perhaps that's what bothers Haman as much as anything else. That even despite writing up this law against the Jews, nothing seems to affect this Mordecai. The steady confidence in the living God who has all things in his hand and under his sovereign power. Mordecai is a superb example for us of what it means to trust in God, even when everything's going against us. To have this great confidence that God never breaks a promise. That God always keeps his word. If he's promised to save you, he will save you. If he's promised to keep you, he will keep you. If he's promised that he will be with you, whatever your circumstances, whatever joys you may go through, and whatever trials you may have to endure, he will be with you. And when he says that nothing can separate you from his love, you can be sure nothing can separate you from his love. It's the same confidence that Paul knew, despite having been shipwrecked, despite having been beaten with rods and with whips, despite having been stoned virtually to death, despite having been imprisoned time and time again, Paul knew this same confidence that Mordecai knew. And it's a confidence that we can have too. A confidence in the living God who always keeps his promises. It's a confidence that Esther was learning. And she showed incredible bravery in following Mordecai's example and being obedient to God rather than to men. Doing God's will rather than seeking personal peace and comfort. Now there's a fourth person I need to mention this morning. And that's the Lord Jesus Christ. Who, according to Paul in Philippians chapter 2, did not think it a thing of robbery to consider himself equal with God, but made himself, despite that, despite being equal with God, made himself of no reputation. He took on the form of a bondservant and came in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death on the cross. Therefore God also has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. Esther didn't know whether she would be laying down her life or not, but she went obedient to doing the Lord's will. Jesus Christ came into this world, though very God, he took upon himself human likeness. Being born of a virgin, he grew up in this world. And he knew what was at the end of it all. He knew that he was here to lay down his life. To lay down his life for his people. Esther didn't know how her story was going to unfold, but she had confidence in God that it would all work out okay in the end, because she was in God's will. Jesus Christ knew exactly what lay before him, and he also knew that all would work out okay in the end, that his sacrifice would be accepted and his people would be freed because of his intercession and his substitution and his representation of them. Christ fought a battle for us, and he won, that we should live and fight and possibly die for him, that we should be obedient to him and walk in his footsteps, and be prepared to sacrifice ourselves in obedience to him, just as Esther was willing to sacrifice herself in obedience to God for the people of God. Love of God, love for God, means obedience to God. If you love me, Jesus said, you will keep my commands. You will do what I want you to do. Do we? Do we love God with all our heart? And is it evident by the fact that we are willing to make personal sacrifices in obedience to God? That we're not pursuing this world's riches, but we're laying for ourselves treasures in heaven. That we're not simply trying to live a comfortable life in this world, but we're giving of our time and of our energy and of our possessions for the good of God's people and for the spread of his kingdom. Haman was out to fill his life with this world's riches. He was on the ladder to success. He was reaching for the top. That was where he strived to be. He's very much like Satan, actually. Isaiah speaks of Satan in Isaiah chapter 14. Listen to these words and see how it may be a forecast of Haman's end. In Isaiah chapter 14 and verses 12 to 15. How you have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Haman was on his way to the top. When you do it the way that he does it, it's the shortest way to the bottom. Mordecai was a humble man. His cousin was an imitator of him. Both feared God, both humbled themselves before God, and both, as we will see, were exalted by God. Are we willing to humble ourselves in the work of the Lord? To lay aside any claims that we may think that we have to comfort, to peace, to rest and happiness? Are we willing to say to God, I will do your will. If I perish, I perish. If I lose all my possessions, I lose them all. If I find myself surrounded by ferocious wolves who seek my life, so be it. I will walk in your ways. I will do your will. You see, this story isn't about who stands on the moral high ground. It's not about Esther and Mordecai being morally superior to this vile Haman. Everyone sees that. The world sees that. This book is about obedience to God. It's about doing God's will, even when it may mean death. You who are Christians here this morning, how much do you love God? And how much is that love evidenced in the sacrifices you make in your life?